Text 25, Chapter 7, Scheduled Incarnations. This has a very short purport. I thought it was longer. But we'll just read the translation. When Ravana was engaged in the battle, the trunk of the elephant which carried the king of heaven, Indra, broke to pieces, having collided with the chest of Ravana, and the scattered parts illuminated all directions. Ravana felt, therefore, proud of his prowess, and began to loiter in the midst of the fighting soldiers, thinking himself the conqueror of all directions. But his laughter, overtaken by joy, along with his very air of life, suddenly ceased with the tingling sound of the bow of Ramachandra, the personality of Godhead. The one sentence purport, however powerful a living being may be, when he is condemned by God, no one can save him. And similarly, however weak one may be, if he is protected by the Lord, no one can annihilate him. So this is mixing the fight between Ravana and Indra with the fight between Ravana and Ramachandra. However powerful someone may be, when Krishna's got your number, that's it. And monkeys and bears with stones and sticks and trunks of trees fighting against great warriors with powerful weapons, mystic powers, chariots, elephants, destroyed if they're not protected by the Lord. So the next verse is related, at least some of the message of it is related, about the powerful Supreme Lord protecting when demoniac personalities are giving harassment to innocent people, poor, weak individuals. So this is about Krishna. Text 26, when the world is overburdened by the fighting strength of kings who have no faith in God, the Lord, just to diminish the distress of the world, descends with his plenary portion. The Lord comes in his original form with beautiful black hair. And just to expand his transcendental glories, he acts extraordinarily. No one can properly estimate how great he is. And Srila Prabhupada's wonderful purport. This verse is especially describing the appearance of Lord Krishna and his immediate expansion, Lord Baladeva. There they are. Krishna Balaram. Both Lord Krishna and Lord Baladeva are one supreme personality of Godhead. The Lord is omnipotent, and he expands himself in innumerable forms and energies in the whole unit, as known as the one supreme Brahman. Such extensions of the Lord are divided into two divisions, namely personal and differential. The personal expansions are called Vishnu Tattvas, and the differential expansions are called the Jiva Tattvas. And in such expansional activity, Lord Baladeva is the first personal expansion of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's very noticeable in reading the purports that the emphasis that Prabhupada places is less on the lila and more on sambandha gyan. Well, the lila is certainly very wonderful and embedded with great transcendental potency. Unfortunately, if people don't have the ABCs, the sambandha gyan understanding, then that which may be very attractive may be misplaced conceptually. So this very short first paragraph, just without saying and the impersonalist blah blah blah, and but the verse says what it says. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And how to understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has expansions of energies and personal forms and differential parts, all part of the one Supreme Brahman. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, in the Vishnu Purana, as well as in the Mahabharata, both Krishna and Baladeva are mentioned as having beautiful black hair, even in their advanced age. The Lord is called Anupalaksha Margaha, which is in the verse, Anupalaksha Margaha, or in still more technical Vedic terms, Avan Manasa Gochara, : one who is never to be seen or realized by the limited sense perception of the people in general. Anupalaksha margaha avan manasa gochara. So he's like a transcendental lawyer building his case here. Here are these terms. Now how do we apply these terms? He's appearing, but he's not to be seen. But he's appearing, but not to be seen, not to be seen by ordinary senses of the limited sense perception of people in general. Confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7:25, it is said by the Lord, Naham Prakasha Sarvasya Yoga Maya Samavrata. In other words, he reserves the right of not being exposed to anyone. And everyone, only the bona fide devotees, can know him by his specific symptoms. Like the question last night, which picture of Krishna most represents Krishna? Long as these specific symptoms are there, they're all Krishna. And out of many, many symptoms, one symptom is mentioned here in this verse, and that is Sita Krishna Keshaha, or one who is observed always with beautiful black hair. Both Lord Krishna and Lord Baladeva have such hair on their heads. Good place to have hair. And thus, even in advanced age, they appeared like young boys, 16 years old. That is the particular symptom of the Personality of Godhead. In the Brahma Samhita, it is stated that although he is the oldest personality among all living entities, he always looks like a new, youthful boy. That is the characteristic of a spiritual body. The material body is symptomized by birth, death, old age, and diseases, but the spiritual body is conspicuous by the absence of those symptoms. Living entities who reside in the Vaikuntha lokas, in eternal life and bliss, have the same type of spiritual body without being affected by any signs of old age. It is described in the Bhagavatam, Canto 6, that the party of Vishnu Dutas, who came to deliver Ajamila from the clutches of the party of Yamaraj, appeared like youthful boys, corroborating the description of this verse. It is ascertained thus that the spiritual bodies in the Vaikuntha lokas, either the Lord or of the other inhabitants, are completely distinct from the material bodies of this world. Therefore, when the Lord descends from that world to this world, he descends in his spiritual body of Atma Maya, or internal potency, without any touch of the Bahiranga Maya, or the external material energy. The allegation that the impersonal Brahman appears in this material world by accepting a material body is quite absurd. Of course, this is a principal doctrine of Shankaracharya, that forms of the Lord are covered Brahman. It's nice covering, very rarefied feature of goodness, but material. Quite absurd. The allegation that the impersonal Brahman appears in the material world by accepting a material body is quite absurd. So how did he establish that? Who wants to reconstruct the argument? He's a lawyer proving his case before the judge.
Well, the first point was made with those two technical Sanskrit terms, that the Lord is not perceivable by material senses. That was the first.
Okay, then the next. Let's go step by step. That's what you're saying is true. The next step is, but he is knowable by the devotees according to specific symptoms. One of those symptoms is his beautiful black hair.
His youthfulness.
Huh?
His youthfulness.
Yeah. And because it's beautiful black hair, when he gets old and the Kurukshetra battle, he's still got beautiful black hair. It's not gray hair, white hair, bald, body falling apart. He's ever youthful. So what kind of a body is that? Ever youthful body that doesn't age. It's not a material body. It's deductive logic. It's not a material body. What kind of body is it? It's not a material body. It's a spiritual body. So How does the Lord appear here with a spiritual body? By his own potency, his spiritual potency. Therefore, to assert those who make the claim, Brahman appears in this world covered with a material body. Quite absurd. Let's look at Krishna's body. Go reverse. Ever youthful. Hairs that never turn gray. Balaram too. And these are symptoms by which he who is anupalaksha margaha, he who is not to be deceived by material senses, you use your material senses to see him, you're going to see something other than him. You may see something. You may see metal and wood and the deity form. Or you may see material covering if you're a Mayavadi. But then you don't see the Lord. the impersonal. Therefore, the Lord, when he comes here, has not a material body, but a spiritual body. The impersonal Brahmajyoti is only the glaring effulgence of the body of the Lord, and there is no difference in quality between the body of the Lord and the impersonal ray of the Lord called Brahmajyoti. He's about ready to rest his case, but he has something else he wants to say. Now, the question is, why the Lord, who is omnipotent, comes here to diminish the burden created upon the world by the unscrupulous kingly order? Certainly the Lord does not need to come here personally for such purposes, but he actually descends to exhibit his transcendental activities in order to encourage his pure devotees who want to enjoy life by chanting the glories of the Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita 9:13 and 14, it is stated that the Mahatmas, the great devotees of the Lord, what do they do? They take pleasure in chanting the activities of the Lord. All Vedic literatures are meant for turning one's attention towards the Lord and his transcendental activities. Thus, the activities of the Lord in his dealings with worldly people create a subject matter for discussion by his pure devotees. There was a comment while I was in India. I began the seventh chapter, and verse after verse after verse about the pastimes of the Lord in different manifestations. And after some days of that, one devotee said, "I'm so accustomed to being attentive when hearing from scripture about the process of devotional service, tuned into what is that process, how to apply the process, and going back to my life and applying the process and hearing the pastimes of the Lord. It's a whole other kind of way of listening and processing that which we're hearing." Prabhupada is saying the same thing here in this, or offering the explanation. It's a means by which the minds of the devotees can be absorbed in Krishna, or his various incarnations. When those forms of the Lord come and perform their pastimes, it's wonderful subject matter to absorb the mind in glorifying the Lord, appreciating the Lord, to a certain degree trying to understand, or at least marveling at how he exhibits his potencies. Like that discussion of why Ram stood behind trees to kill Vali, or why Lord Nityananda broke Lord Chaitanya's danda in three places. There was one sadhu in Champahati. He's now deceased, but he was from his life as a young boy, as a teenager, he was given the service by Bhakti Siddhanta to stay and serve the deities of Gaur Gadadhar. And till he was in his 90s, he was serving the deities of Gaur Gadadhar. That's a pujari for you. And he was such a nectarian, sweet person. And each time I went there, he would want to bring up the topic that he was meditating on his whole life, of the pastime of Lord Nityananda breaking the danda of Lord Chaitanya. Just meditating on the meaning, the import of that lila. and relishing. So then when he would share what his realizations were, it was a thrill. I mean, it was like, you know, grabbing hold of spiritual electricity. It was a jolt of ecstasy. So the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead provide means for the devotee to absorb their mind in thinking of the Lord. It is stated in the Bhagavad Gita that the Mahatmas, great devotees of the Lord, take pleasure in chanting the activities of the Lord. All Vedic literatures are meant for turning one's attention towards the Lord and His transcendental activities. Thus, the activities of the Lord in His dealings with worldly people create a subject matter for discussion by His pure devotees. So there's the pastimes of the Lord in the spiritual world, and there's the pastimes of the Lord as He appears in this world, where in this world there's, of course, there's devotees, but there's also non-devotees. And how the Lord deals with those two categories of personalities, we heard just yesterday that His exhibition of anger and His exhibition of mercy are absolute. So the effect is upliftment and deliverance and purification and bringing those souls closer to Him. But one dealing is this way, the other dealing is that way. So it's apparent anger or transcendental anger. Transcendental anger directed with Ram at Varuna and Ram at Lakshman when Lakshman left Sita and Ram at Ravana. There's certainly different categories of transcendental anger. There's a variety of transcendental anger. But purification, purification, purification. Reciprocation of the moods of love. And for the devotee, it's providing us with transcendental subject matter. And it's that providing us with transcendental subject matter has a result. We become attached to the personality of Godhead. It was nice, just last night I was listening, kind of eavesdropping on the chatter of the devotees that were when they were taking prasadam, and many of them were speaking about, you know, this thing with the Lord, pastimes of Ramachandra, and instead of, like Prabhupada says, the price of rice. You know, spiritual subject matters. That directly purify. So there's two things that the pastime, hearing of and chanting the pastimes of the Lord do. You come in contact with the Supreme Pure, you become pure, so purification and nurturing affinity, replacing the affinity for the material with spiritual. So becoming attached, uplifted and attached to the Supreme Lord. And going back to before this chapter begins, Brahma says to Narada, he's the one that's narrating, he says that as far as the Purusha Sukta confirmed things that I've described, everything is correct and perfect. Sounds like a proud statement. But then he says, this is only because I've firmly grasped the lotus feet of the Lord, and because He's supremely pure, He has purified and empowered my words. That's the only reason. As far as knowing the Lord, not possible. Not possible for me, Lord Shiva, you name it, not possible. For the tiny to know the infinite, for the finite to know the infinite, cannot be, except to some small degree according to how the degree of surrender and submission unto the Lord, then he discloses himself. To that degree, one can know. And he says it again and says it again. So, the messages of the personality of Godhead and his lilas and his qualities, his loving exchanges, they're like him, literally unfathomable for the tiny living entity to understand. But to some degree, and to that some degree, that's also mammoth, or to speak of the unlimitedness of the Supreme Lord. But Prabhupada wants us, while saying all of this, to focus on the specific qualities of the Lord and how those specific qualities disclose his transcendental nature. Just this one little phrase, his Sita Krishna Keshaha, his beautiful black hair. And just see what Prabhupada did with the beautiful black hair phrase. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And those who claim otherwise, it's absurd. Very logically. Glories to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All glories to the Supreme. This is the disposition of the devotee. And when he appears, he is otherwise not to be seen by those with limited sense perception from people in general. He's not to be seen in that way. Same thing that Brahma said, he's unknowable. He just described, and he said, everything I've said is perfect. It can never be refuted by anyone, because the Lord has empowered my words in that way, because I've taken shelter. I've enthusiastically wrapped my arms around his lotus feet, and I'm holding, clinging tightly. So whatever I speak, he upholds it. It can never be wrong. Very nice. So, and the Lord is Vishnu Tattva, and his expansion Balaram is also Vishnu Tattva. And this other idea, Brahman covered. Well, not so. Naham Prakasha Sarvasya Yoga Maya Samavata. He covers those living entities with his deluding potency so they cannot know him. And they become as convinced as we are convinced that Brahman is covered. And we're convinced Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Any discussion?
Well, thank you very much. Recently, somebody asked me this question. Can't go and take up a form. And I quoted from another Gita, but this way, how I thought of a question that I can't seem to, I don't know what, how to answer that. If the question were to be, Brahman gets covered or takes up a form that has these qualities of, you know, ever youthful and never gets gray hair, for example, versus a regular human form, how to answer that? It's just that, you know, Brahman just takes up a spiritual form or a different kind of.
It's like word jugglery. Da 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 da. Matter is temporary. Matter deteriorates. Matter is under the influence of time. So, you know, supposing Bhaktisiddhanta calls this working hypothesis. Supposing matter were eternal. Supposing the forms of matter were eternal. You know, you start with that premise that's in itself flawed. Whatever you put on top of that is going to be flawed. The mathematical calculation that the error that's at the very beginning is going to amplify as you go further in the mathematical calculation. So the premise of the forms of matter are unchanging is a false premise, my dear sir. Matter is ever changing and spirit is unchanging. Mayavadi votes. So how is that? The premise is false. And therefore the conclusion is flawed. Another full stop to that presentation is, my dear sir, let's just assume for a moment this false premise is a fact. Can you please describe how Brahman, which is supreme, becomes covered? That would mean that the covering is superior to Brahman. So the covering is supreme. How is it that Brahman becomes covered? Or conversely, should we call the covering supreme? And Brahman is illusion. Their response to that, well, you know, sometimes, is the answer to that question is there is no covering. Because all there is Brahman. There is no covering. Called circular reasoning. Anything else?
You so much come to love Prabhupada just the way we know him, and it's hard to imagine him in any other form. Does he look the same in this tradition?
The in the life of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he, in his writings in Sharanagati, he describes his form in his spiritual identity. And it's a Manjari, not only, you know, female as opposed to male, but certainly differently looking than Bhaktivinoda Thakur's physical body looked. For example, we're going to be hearing tomorrow morning about Shyamananda in his spiritual form came before Srimati Radharani, and it wasn't in his Shyamananda body. His Shyamananda body was on this plane, and his spiritual body came before Krishna, came before Radha. So the answer is no. Then the next question is, well, how will we recognize him? If he doesn't look the same. By transcendental emotion is the only answer that I have to offer. One will recognize. Krishna will arrange by transcendental emotion to recognize. So, you know, the relationships are manifest not due to a physical form, but through transcendental emotion. The transcendental relationships are there. And that's how one will recognize. Mujukunda, when he was he saw Krishna for the first time, he didn't recognize Krishna. He was a great devotee of Krishna, but he had never seen him. And then when he saw him, they had conversation for some time before he realized, this is Krishna. Krishna was enjoying the conversation, and then he realized it was Krishna, and he was overjoyed. But he realized through the medium of the transcendental emotion, not, oh, here's what Krishna looks like, I saw in a picture somewhere, that must be him. When Hanuman was looking for Sita, he didn't have a picture of Sita, but he could understand by transcendental emotion and the exchange with Sita and the qualities of Sita, this must be Sita. Must have an answer to that question. What do? We give the transcendental form of Krishna, the transcendental name of Krishna, describe the transcendental qualities. So the medium of music or art simply needs the object, the form of Krishna, the name of Krishna, the qualities of Krishna, pastimes of Krishna. And when in contact with that, it purifies and elevates. The happiness of Krishna Kirtan cannot be compared to the happiness of anything else. And so on. The perfection of each of the refined arts is reposed on the personality of Godhead. Now, there may very well be persons, I know of at least one of them, who makes the argument that certain classical music forms are simply but expressions of glorification of God. And so whether it's this form or that form, glorifications of God is the force of inspiration within that classical music or other forms of classical art, architecture, painting, writing, inspired by God. And I don't really want to go down that path too much. The distinction, one thing I would offer is that the distinction of the name of Krishna and the form of Krishna is more complete. And and therefore more attractive and more satisfying than a symphony that's God, you know, inspired by "I wish to glorify God." Just more complete form of expression. And one who hears it also receives that personality of Godhead, specific glorification or potency and upliftment. Cyclic succession. And you can't compare that to, well, there's something that has, that is in that composition that just cannot be in the composition of a God-inspired person. Bill just sent out something on Mozart's birthday. Did you receive that? Are you on his list? Our flute player? Yeah, I'm on the list. It's mostly I just delete stuff, but
a lot of delete.
Huh?
A lot of delete.
But Mozart was very inspired the quotes that Mozart said, you know, that music which is not is lifeless, not God inspired, lifeless. So he, you know, there was some very clear inspiration in his life, and that's not to be poo-pooed or ignored. So there was something going on in his work, life, the expression of that inspiration, not to be compared with what Panchatattva just said. No, it's nice. It's inspiring. Something else? Yeah.
In Ramayana, how can we understand? How should we understand the pastime where Lord Ramachandra worships Lord Shiva before going to the...
We discussed this. You missed yesterday morning's class, but I'll just repeat it. Three things. One is, it's not in Valmiki Ramayana, it's in Tulsi Ramayana. So, in Tulsi Ramayana, because in Valmiki Ramayana, he goes to the shore of the ocean and fasts. He's wanting, but so this is, he goes to Shiva worship and is invoking the mercy of Lord Shiva so he can accomplish this difficult task. In Tulsi Ramayana, there are not an unlimited, but a number of places where a tinge of impersonalism, it's all one kind of idea, is there. Therefore, Prabhupada said we should not read Tulsi Ramayana. Other persons that cannot not read Tulsi Ramayana. Because they grew up with Tulsi Ramayana, and that's, you know, that's the flavor they like. It's not chocolate or vanilla or strawberry, it's Tulsi Ramayana. But there's a tinge of impersonalism. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is that Ram's Leela was to show the ideal king. And the ideal king is respectful to all. It's like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, as a sannyasi, that is the personality of Godhead, he went to so many temples, including many Shiva temples, and he would enjoy Krishna Kirtan in the Shiva temple, appreciating here such a great devotee of the Lord. So as an ideal king wanting to invoke the mercy of such an ideal devotee of the Lord in order to fulfill a difficult task, to get the mercy of a devotee of the Lord. So what we discussed yesterday was the authorized presentations and authorized commentaries of authorized presentations. One is best sticking to that authorized version, because otherwise some confusion is undoubtedly going to enter. And there are persons that like to put Ram and Shiva on the same platform, or Ram and Vishnu on the same platform, or Ram, Vishnu, Brahma and Shiva on the same platform, or everybody on the same platform. Everybody. It's the same. It's just a version of the same, making no distinctions. And because if you make distinctions, they're discriminating against, as opposed to transcendental distinctions. We're not discriminating against. The sense of variegatedness on the spiritual platform is an unknown concept to some people. It's just something they cannot enter into. It looks like something that it isn't. Looks like something material. And so, as Hindus, we don't discriminate. Meaning in a negative way. But, it's also minus the positive way, making distinctions. So we can hear from anybody about anything, because we're Hindus. Panchatattva, you want to add something?
We had a chance the other day to see something. I had a chance to see something I hadn't seen in a very long time. It's that video from Krishna Maharaj speaking in Sura Fiji,
in Fiji.
God's demigods and incarnations.
Do you know that was canned? I mean, the audience were devotees.
Oh.
Okay. Some people didn't know.
I knew that some of them were devotees.
They're devotees.
What about the fellow that said that Sai Baba was also a devotee?
It was all scripted.
Wow. Really?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, it was really good.
Okay. So your comment is?
He had actors in the audience.
Yeah, he did.
Who were presenting various personalities as the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And one elderly one to choose a bit of all. All of them.
Okay, last.
Then I'll tie to this discussion with Anand's question. What's the difference between mental cultivation and mental adjustment?
I don't understand the question. What's the difference between mental cultivation and mental adjustment? Do you understand the question?
Cultivation, at least my very rudimentary understanding. We encourage to mentally cultivate, that is, let's say, absorb our mind in Krishna and Lila and so forth, versus, I think, mental adjustment, the way I see it anyway, is trying to be on a platform where you're probably not. This is a principle and trying to mention.
Well, then maybe just use different terminology to resolve your lack of clarity, because I've never heard these terms made like this. Just hit the delete button and use other terminology. Mm-hmm. What's recommended is that we culture absorbing the mind and thought of Krishna. That's on the plus side, and the zero side is we don't you know, sit in a room and close the doors and try to imagine what Krishna looks like or Krishna is like, or imagine what a relationship with Krishna is like. We're encouraged, discouraged from speculating about Krishna, stretching the mind and trying to encompass Krishna that way. Absorb the mind but not speculate.
So, and specifically, like say, I'm in a situation where it's at work, for example, it's tough and it's a stressful situation. And, okay. Oh, I'm not supposed to think like this. The results are not my doing.
So that's the intelligence bringing the mind to its proper position. That's not a mental adjustment. It's exercising. It's letting Krishna's instructions direct your intelligence, which then directs the mind.
There's a constant struggle.
That's because we're not surrendered to Krishna. And in fact, we're addicted to the other. We're addicted to struggling. What's life without doing that? Krishna, please pick me up out of this ocean of material existence. So that's not a mental adjustment. Mental adjustment is imagining something, speculating something. As Prabhupada said, that the chanting of the holy name of Krishna is not a imposition upon the mind. It's not something from out there, and you bring it in here, and then it just puts a vice around the mind, and then you know that it's configured in a certain. It's natural to the soul, natural condition of the mind to be attracted to Krishna, not an artificial imposition upon the mind, not a mental adjustment. It's a natural condition. A natural condition is in relation with Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.